established that there are lots of problems with the solar dynamo. One of the things we want to do is, this picture seems to work very well in nuclear pumping. One of the things we want to do is understand some of these parameterizations and actually go in and understand the physics of each process that may be occurred in the part of the picture. We think we can only do this in isolation. You can't go away and try and do the whole thing. What we want to do is understand each part of each system and put it together to get a picture of what they track. So, for example, we might want to understand the turbulent transport of magnetic flux. One of the things you have to do is remove magnetic flux from the convection zone to put it in the ocean region when it gets soil. So that process is known as magnetic pumping, and that's how maybe the then we want to understand that if we do have a large shear here and a large magnetic field, how that large shear may extend the field into the structures may rise back into the convection zone, the convection shear bonuses, basically, stuff like that. One of the other things we want to understand is how is it that this is not clear to me at all. How is it that a flux tube can make it all the way through the circuit? If we're calculating over here, and I know that the overheating production is really, really efficient to stay in the system. How is it that my model works? Life is through this convection without getting to the circuit. And finally, so, first thing I think is,
there are recent calculations by Tom Benford looking at rising magnetic flux tubes, presumably starting off from a situation that looks very much like that, that sort of taking one of those arches in isolation and rising and twisting, and she claims it can explain the structure of delta spots. Take that for as much as you're worth. There's also the question, she's starting off with a single flux tube, which means somehow it disconnected itself from the base of the convection zone, and how it did that is not addressed.
Yes, well, I mean that's...
But that's another piece of the puzzle.
That's the length of, that's right, that if you like, is the later piece. Yeah, I mean there are, that's both there. And I've collaborated with them, working on that. Mark here has done work on that. So there is the problem of rising flux tubes and how they fall apart or don't fall apart. The problem there is that I've worked on that. Remember at the beginning there was a picture of subdividing the field in a rather small scale, probably driven by motions that are not rotationally affected. And there's been a lot of work on so-called fast dynamos, dynamos at high magnetic resonance numbers, and all the work has been kind of small-scale dynamos. So the field is on the scale of the flow doesn't have to have elasticity, for example. This is just the kind of flow that people look at. This is Galileian Proxima, famous paper flow, which is a very simple flow. It's the old Geo Roberts dynamo made time periodic. So this is the flow for instances in time. It's a 2D, quote, 2D flow. Has all three components, of course, but only dependence on X and Y. The blue spin dark stuff you can think of as swirling around and going in the light. So from a Noetherian point of view, this is a flow. It used to be a fast dynamo by a dynamo to a dynamo is an improvement flow. That launching tail. So this is what we call the launching tail. This is the best.
Find a reason for myself outside the thermodynamics, and the reason for the reason for myself. Why would people use the alpha effect and not some any viscosity, which is very dramatic to hydrodynamics, which would be like a gradient of things.
So
alpha being gradient, not the gradient. So that's the very thing.
And the big answer.
It's not historical. The idea is that the average value of U prime cross V prime is proportional to the mean field times input. And then actually there are other terms that involve some gradients.
If what, pure isotropic situations which don't have velocity, I'd go through it. The final result of this calculation, the temporal behavior of L, which is shown in the first part over here, and
the boundary condition.
The top boundary condition is such that when we appear in a vertical, and the third flat boundary conditions are the theorem sheet approximation. So, that means that the periodicity with respect to a position that is steering as a function of time. In the same way as the sun is in a vision. So in other words, if you look as a cross section like this from the top, and the direction of shear is like this, the position that is initially periodic means that the counterpart of an element which goes straight apart in this direction will come back to the opposite location, the vertical bar. At a somewhat later time, those coordinate positions have shifted. So at this point, they have shifted upwards and lower, the corresponding points have shifted downwards. And so you have a periodicity which is fully conservative. So it's nothing which is coming out here is lost, being fully restored on the other side, but that is a shifted position. So that is a condition that has been used over the decades, actually, in connection with the plastic dynamics and also the
Okay. It
is a condition that is maybe funny, yeah, but it's rigorous in the limit of large, rigorous in the limit of large radii. So then it's exact for large radii, infinite radii. But I think we come back to this discussion actually in the context with shear stabilities. So here is the kinetic energy of convection. It's shown in the dotted line. And then we have put in initially a weak Irving Street magnetic field that is weaker by more than 6 orders of magnitude. The magnetic field increases exponentially as we will always expect in that dynamo. And eventually it saturates at a level somewhat below the kinetic energy. In this calculation, the resolution is 63 cubed. I'm showing you later animations where the toroid is sent as covered. The magnetic ground number is 120, the Reynolds number is 240, so the magnetic ground number is 4.5, less than 1, and the thermal ground number is 4.2. So that was the first part, then we have something like closer position, but not exact. Our next part is the mean magnetic field. The modulus of the mean magnetic field as a function of time. As you see initially, there's a very big C magnetic field, mean, and that too grows like the total energy, like my energy grows at time, and then it saturates. The solid line is the toroidal magnetic field, and the dotted line is the poloidal magnetic field, the radial magnetic field. And that saturates at a level which is approximately 10, factor of 10 less than the toroidal magnetic field. The spikes are simply because it's an average, it's a modulus of an average, and so once that goes to zero, of course, you have a spike in this logarithmic representation is minus infinity.
Can I ask you about the boundary conditions again? Because at least most calculations when you have magnetic functions that are needed, the meaning of the flux is the flux itself.
That's the case if you have either periodic boundary conditions or if you have perfectly conducting boundary conditions. And so I could have a perfectly conducting boundary condition in the top, but at the top I have a vertical field condition. And that no longer describes the flux to be constant. The same we have done in efficient disk, and that is fine. That would be a lot of magnetic.
It's possible to either lose flux to the side or draw flux in.
Right. Now, so there is a large-scale magnetic field developing here, which does not seem to change sign, or it would show a spike in my activity. The field itself, the two components have roughly opposite orientation. Here you see the toroidal magnetic field is more negative. Now, if you plot the ratio of that is actually what I just erased here. If you plot the ratio of the average and the average stress. So it's the other way around. And this is what the committee has represented here. It is initially small, even very close to zero, but that's not mean magnetic field, it's just instant time. But then, as the magnetic field actually begins to become dynamically important, at that time, this ratio becomes of order a fifth, typically, or a sixth or something. So this ratio actually grows as you go into the dynamical. Now I want to show you.
So this thing is thermal. So you've got thermal convection things. And this imposed, you always have this body force imposing this shear.
Yes. All the time.
So, and what is the net? In reality, the convection leads to the differential rotation.
That's right. Yeah, that
how does your convection change your differential rotation profile?
Not at all. That is ignored. And the motivation for this is because it is in the local framework, it is relatively hopeless to do a calculation where you get realistic differential rotation. If you want to get a differential rotation more or less realistically, you really have to go to a global calculation. On the other hand, the magnetic aspects appear to be possible to simulate at least in the framework of a frictionless sphere beyond that. You can get large scale magnetic field generation in a way that is not drastically unrealistic, even in the framework of a local frictionless sphere. Yeah, actually, okay, can you turn it on?
Thank you, Roman.
Either you just push play or you do it. Yeah, right. So here you see, first of all, the contours of the differential rotation in this particular model. It has to be symmetric in order to get the contours. And what is shown here is the toroidal magnetic field as color coded. So this is zero. And the vectors show the average magnetic field, average over the toroidal direction. And that is the one we have in the perpendicular direction 127 net points. So overall these net points are established here. So you see, you may be surprised that if the toroidal field isn't as open as I say, the convection zone is between 0 and 1. The other part is upper ocean layer, and everything below 1 is the lower ocean layer. And so at these times, and we should compare this with early times, you see there's a remarkable toroidal magnetic field all the way to the bottom of the convection zone. Ideally, you would like to extend this bar. Okay, now, you can stop at center, okay? Maybe you can just click it by hand. It starts, the difference is 5,100. In fact, such that gravity is 1 and so this is traditionally, you see that higher than the average when you see an overloading action. This calculation started off initially already with the dynamically important magnetic field because it has to be rematched from the calculation I showed you. So, as time goes on now, you see that some of the toroidal magnetic field gets all of a sudden strongly pushed into the lower orbit layer. And of course, the subject to shear. So at this point, subject to shear, the subject to shear, so here you see you build up this toroidal magnetic field. It's very difficult to get rid of, because once it is there, there is not any convection that can destroy it. So, the other thing we can show is the visualization of the magnetic field in 3D. That there is first of all a strong magnetic field being generated, and not only small scale but also large scale. And I think that's the most important point. The ratio between small scale and large scale fields becomes smaller, it becomes diminished as it reaches the nonlinear region. The field is mostly in the toroidal direction, that is a factor due to the shear. And there's no reversal at this point, which I don't think should be taken as a problem as far as the semiconductor topic. This is a local simulation and a global aspect of the magnetic field. It will always depend on the geometry of the box.
As your calculation progresses, you get flux points towards the bottom, so you have a large mean field, as you sit there, which you don't have at the start, so you have a large mean field at the bottom.
Yeah, but of course, how do you get there? How do you get there? And there is still a diffusion going on in the bottom of the electron zone, so it can be. So I think there's no problem with this particular setup.
But would you say it's a non-linear effect, or would you say it's a pattern?
I think that the fact that the ratio becomes 0.1 or 0.2 is a non-linear effect, yes. And that has nothing to do with the fact that there's accumulation of field at the bottom. I think it is actually still the strongest, just at above the ocean layer. It's just pumped over, it's pumped into the unstable layer, of course, by the velocity. The velocity is relatively large in a simulation which is not exactly solar-like. For solar convection, of course, you have extremely small Mach numbers, which you don't have here. You have a Mach number 10, of course, the 10 to minus 4. So our velocities are too high, and therefore the overshoot is too strong. So that's all probably understandable. No, it's actually comparable. I think by all of my needs is comparable to the gradient of the RMS velocity and the correlation length here. So the field is really strongest, and it is intermittent in the box. But it is weak also in the overshoot layer. But once you average, of course, much of the stuff in the convection zone really averages to zero, and it's therefore only by chance that that you will have the greatest chance of having a non-zero exactly at the bottom of the convection zone. So that's how the simulation looks like. But I think that is an important consideration here. So whenever we go to realistic flows that are not necessarily constructed flows, as Otto was saying already, we are likely to have strong dynamo action. Secondly, if we allow for the effect of shear, which in this case are not dynamically consistently calculated, but otherwise we know that there is shear, then this shear will have a strong effect on the toroidal field, and can give rise to magnetic fields that are close to equation. By the way, in equation, this is even super equation. Any other questions? Okay. Should I show you? the calculation of convection is part of the traces. And so here you see the mixing and the convection calculation. And the color coded or grayscale coded is the entropy. So the entropy is low in the lower surface areas in layers of glass. It's also getting lower again as you go into the stable strength region. Also, you see here.
But what does it begin at? 2
You mean it's time zero? Or what do you mean?
What about the stable region?
The stable region is between 1 and 100.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's a big area here where it's possible. Mm-hmm. And if you really need that, the glass will go so high.
What is S?
S is the entropy.
Oh, okay. What is the
It's a flux at large relative to the sphere of some cube times density, this is a calculation which has been remeshed from a lower resolution calculation. The particular down graph is apparently extremely strong, and it's a strong push of particles. Now those particles are the particles that were initially in the plane, and so after some time these particles may go out of the plane, and they're still shown in one in the same plane. So if you see, for example, entropy structures, later times they may not necessarily coincide anymore with the corresponding particle trajectories. So here you see one block of low entropy material has gone deep down already, but much of the downgoing material has begun to overturn already. Here you see a major extent has been cleared out here. And now you see that so by this time, all of the particles have totally mixed those squares. Initially, all the particles were color-coded such that black was the top, red was in the convection zone, and yellow and white is in the overshoot layer. So initially, they are separated by height, but as time goes on, you see a tremendous amount of mixing, so eventually, it's quite color-coded here. Yeah.